other and take the ferry to Prince Edward Island, an even more remote province. The ferry to the island was enormous, and there were only about 4 people on it. And when we docked, things looked pretty barren. A guy with a Billy Gibbons beard sat behind a picnic table selling wooden clocks shaped like Prince Edward Island itself. You couldn't even get a bottle of water, but you could buy a homemade clock from a Canadian hillbilly. No offense, hillbillies. We figured we would head to town and grab lunch before we went to our inn. There were only 2 things open, a fish restaurant and a knife factory. We ate at the fish restaurant, which was empty. The waitress told us it was off-season. Things pick up again in May, she said. After lunch, we strolled over to the knife factory and bought a bread knife. Then we went to our inn, which, like everywhere else we had been on this trip, was located on a quaint harbor. No offense, quaint harbors. The next morning, we planned to head to a national forest and take a walk. We're not very outdoorsy, but there wasn't much else to do unless we wanted to get day work at a sawmill. We filled a backpack and headed in the car to the other side of the island, intent on embracing our isolation. It might not be fun, but we would give ourselves over to the solitude of nature. We pulled up and looked at the wooden placard that marked the trails. A huge expanse of forest unfolded before us. We chose the 1.5-mile loop. I mean, we wanted outdoor adventure, but, you know, a very small amount. We zipped up our jackets and plunged into the deep Canadian wilderness. As we made our way, the forest grew quiet and trees canopied us from the light. We walked through in silence. About 15 minutes in, we were doing relatively well, although I could sense a mild level of dread. There was a definite forced peacefulness, like a grimace and a teeth clenched, "Isn't this a nice walk?" As we turned a corner, I saw it, only a few yards in front of us, looming in the center of the path, a sizable brown clump, a whopping pile of animal dung. And this was not some ordinary pile. This was a massive load. We approached it slowly, and it was still seeming. "This looks like fresh bear shit," I said. I saw her face go ashen. Diplomatic, I repeated, "This is definitely bear shit." Note, I have no idea what bear shit looks like. Somehow I'd forgotten then that bears attack people, and this might alarm her, who, remember, had a baby in her. But more to the point, I was distracted by my mortal terror that a bear was nearby. Her look turned to horror, and our peaceful walk suddenly shifted in tone. She started striding ahead down the path, murmuring incoherently. Her fear exacerbated my fear, and I ran ahead, senselessly babbling out ideas of what we should do if we were confronted by a bear. She quickened to keep up with me, taking heavy breaths and exhaling loudly and rhythmically. We looked like we were in a speedwalk race. She sounded as if she were in labor. I eventually stopped talking, and we walked together at this clipped pace, staring straight ahead in a full state of panic. Everything went away except the primal instinct to survive. The last thing I remember saying was, "Don't run, just walk fast." Suddenly, I heard something coming from behind us. I didn't even want to turn around. I was certain this was it. Who would the bear take first? Would I sacrifice myself to save my girlfriend and our baby? The sound grew louder. Instantly, and without fanfare, 2 teenage girls in jogging shorts swept past us in a split second. They smiled and waved hello. My girlfriend and I looked at each other blankly. We walked the rest of the path and back to the car. Amy wanted to leave the next day, a day earlier than we planned. I could only comply. On our way home, I bought a wooden clock from the hillbilly as a keepsake of our island journey. When I look back on that trip, I wonder why I wanted it to be that bad. Maybe when you set your sights very low, you can't be overly disappointed. But we will always have that shared experience of sort of possibly being potentially attacked by a bear. That stands out more than some great trip to some eco-resort in Cozumel. Plus, I still have that bread knife. Chapter 15. How I Failed as a New Father. The moment when I decided to ejaculate, I knew that there was the possibility of future fatherhood. But I was playing the odds. I think it was not the best gamble, an inverted Russian roulette, if you will. Anyway, It was a boy, and I cried when I found out. I was at the O'Hare airport when Amy told me by phone. That's why we named him Sbarro. I admit I was at best confused by the notion that I was to be a parent, but comforted by the fact that millions had done poorly before me. Our son was delivered by C-section, and my first thought as I entered the OR was, why do they not have an entrance where you don't have to walk by the disemboweled body of your partner before crossing past the partition? I know people record their births, but there is a reason nobody records their C-sections. Amy, with the help of much medication, seemed unaware that her insides were draped like dirty laundry on her chest, which is a good thing, I suppose. When my baby was shown to me by the doctor moments later, my mood was already ruined by the sight of internal organs. My girlfriend kept complaining that she was cold, and I imagine it was because her entire lower half was splayed open. Anyway, I don't want to grouse too much, but just a quick revamping of the entryway would have really changed my first-time father moment. From there, it went downhill. First misstep. I did not spend the first night in the hospital with my girlfriend. The baby is kept in a nursery separated except for feeding, so I figured I would go out to dinner. Oh, and it wasn't purely selfish, the dinner part, since I was going home to pick up fresh clothes for her, but it was worth getting admonished by the bartender as I ordered a glass of red wine. I just had a baby. Oh, congratulations, when? About 4 hours ago. A sour look crossed his face. Oh, well, what are you doing here? He didn't seem pleased with my getting some clothes at home answer, and peered at me as I sat masticating roast duck. I was like Henry the First, checking quickly on just another male heir, and then back to the banquet. I have fond memories of that duck, though. Second miscalculation. When driving your partner home from the hospital with your baby in a used car in midwinter with poor heating, don't say, I need to stop at Duane Reade to pick up my medication. Also, after she says no, don't argue that it's on the way. And don't stop. But I did. I have high cholesterol. It was being treated with medication. It was pretty much on the way home. I will say that I was highly underprepared to be a father. It is difficult for a narcissist to focus his attention elsewhere, and so I didn't. During the first few months, I did spend a lot of time with my son. And I know from research that in those early days, it is important to provide reassurance. So our days were mainly spent at a newly opened video game bar in the East Village, reassuring me. This childcare haven was generally empty until the neighborhood schools got out at 3:30, so I would have like a good 5 hours of playing system-linked Halo with my baby watching. It takes a village to save Earth from the Covenant. I neglected to tell my girlfriend that our newborn was primarily being reared indoors to the sounds of assault rifles. But look, that sound is not far off from the echoed sounds of a mother's beating heart, so I was mainly providing oral consistency. Third misstep. The park in New York City is basically a second home for child rearing. A good part of early childhood is spent in parks, and a community forms among those who populate those parks. It's where moms and dads and their children form early bonds. It's also where early petty resentments develop. The park is a breeding ground for parents to judge other parents and develop private animosities toward them, the caregivers, and the children. The first and easiest target, for me, was the toddler with the electric-powered car, at least it wasn't diesel, driving around recklessly, wearing the Ed Hardy onesie and sunglasses. Sunglasses on toddlers are wrong. Adult accoutrements on babies are wrong. The act of even partially dressing toddlers as adults is creepy, unless you are dressing them as your favorite occupation, like a chef, or an airline pilot, or a coal miner. I think it would be refreshing to see a baby dressed in coveralls with soot all over his face. But this kid was just an attention seeker. Toddler douchebags are a puzzling group, mainly because they don't even know they're douchebags yet, which just outwardly fuels their douchebagginess. It's an interesting conundrum because adult douchebags are also mostly clueless about being douchebags, and that's, in essence, what makes them douchebags. They think their loud boorishness and ostentation is just a sign of confidence and good spirit. But the smug look on the face of the kid who gets put into an electric-powered mini Hummer may just as easily be the confounded face of a toddler, not necessarily the look of someone who is prodigiously indifferent to the poor. But it is more likely an indicator of early-onset douchebag. I mean, how could you ever not end up cravenly wanting more when at 5 you're already driving an electric Hummer? The park is also a forum for public judgment on how children are raised, and many are not shy about sharing opinions. I wasn't immune to this. I mean, I judged a 5-year-old just for driving a toy car. I judged parents for being overly precious about their babies. I judged parents who spoke harshly to other people's children. I pushed theories of parenting that I knew very little about. In the case of the Scandinavian couple who left their child in a stroller outside a bar in New York City while they went in to drink and defended it as a cultural norm in Scandinavia, I openly supported the couple because I wanted to do that here in America. So imagine how others judged me. One afternoon, I had brought my baby son to the park near our apartment. He had just started to crawl, so this was a huge uptick in excitement for our time together. Prior to this, there was the watching my baby lie and the watching my baby eat. Now, with this new skill, there was the watching my baby crawl. It's not a huge thing, but weeks and weeks go by where very little happens, so even slight changes make a big difference in the day-to-day. I took him out of the stroller to let him crawl freely, and I got myself in a sturdy position to watch. Soon I struck up a conversation with a young mother who was there with her own baby. After a few moments, another woman approached and asked, "Is that your baby?" She pointed to my baby, who was sitting next to a tree, perched up, moving his mouth in a chewing motion. "Yes," I said. "He's eating dog shit," she said. I looked over and, yes, there was a dark brown material in his mouth. So many emotions flowed. I ran over and discovered that, yes, the dark brown material he was eating was the aforementioned dog shit, or maybe human shit, but definitely shit. So this was the moment when my baby was eating shit. I used my finger to clear it out, but there was no determining how much had been eaten. Time was very blurry at this point. Could it have been a whole log? Is more shit worse than a little shit? What is the protocol for baby shit eating? Is it considered healthy in some cultures? Like, do ashrams practice shit eating as a way to develop stomach flora? Sweaty and panicked, I looked over to see the two women looking at me, both like, "How could you let your baby eat shit?" I was in a full-blown panic, so I couldn't help thinking of myself, even as I cleared the remaining crap out of my son's mouth. My son was smiling, almost knowingly smiling, like, "What are you gonna do now?" I quickly asked the two mothers who were silently judging me if they knew whether it was imperative that I take him to the ER. Simultaneously, I thought of the repercussions, like, how do I admit to the attending nurse that I let my son eat shit? I know I should have been thinking of him first, and I know it seems simple enough, but pride is a powerful emotion. And it was early on in the process, so admitting to a failure this catastrophic was a really bad look. In simple terms, was there a way, just wondering, if this whole matter could just go away? Like, could I get some water and wash him clean and we hope for the best, or do we have to go through the whole my telling everyone my baby ate shit thing? Hoping for some direction, I turned to the two women who had witnessed the incident. One immediately said, "I would take him to the ER. And the other quickly followed with, "I wouldn't worry about it." This was the absolute worst possible outcome, a split decision. I really needed clarity, but they started arguing back and forth while I listened on. In an effort to protect myself and my growing reputation as a father, I chose the path of least resistance, hoping for the best. I went home and flushed out his mouth off and on for about 2 hours, then dressed him in his mother's favorite outfit. That evening, when Amy got home, she asked how the day was, and I told her just another day at the park. We looked over at our son, who sat in his bouncy chair, pushing himself up and down with his baby legs, wearing a real shit-eating grin. I will say that in my case, doing nothing did work out, but I would not offer that claim as a general rule for any time a baby eats shit. Chapter 16. How I failed at providing some historical perspective on failure redux. When putting my failures into context, one has to consider the environment I come from, and not just my family and my heritage, but the actual place where I am from. With that, we can pin some blame on the failures of early America and see how those failures gave root to our personal failures now. Maybe if I could learn a bit about why America's manifest success is not what it seems, I could better understand my failures as a product thereof. Most Americans at this point in our history feel like America is essentially a success story, but one has to look deeper in order to get a sense of the cracks that developed from its early settlement. I reached out to Temple University Native American history professor Andrew Eisenberg to bring some clarity to this matter and to better lay out how certain aspects of America's culture were doomed to fail from the beginning of our journey as a nation based on failures of communication and basic misunderstandings. May 17, 2017. Professor Eisenberg, my name is John Benjamin, and I'm writing a book having to do with my personal failures in my life, and I just checked my word count, and my publishing contract obligates me to write over 75,000 words, and I'm not even halfway there, and my deadline is in 2 weeks. So pardon me, but I'm pretty fucked. I know this seems out of the blue, but is there any way you can write a little bit about how the colonists failed with the Indians for me? It would be a real help, word count-wise. I tried with another professor earlier in my writing process, and he stopped writing me back. Hopefully, you can see it in your heart to help me. If not for anything else, to get your very important work out there to be seen by more people. John. May 19th, 2017. Dear John, I'm sorry about your predicament. Your question is quite broad. In any survey of encounters between settlers and Indians, one doesn't have to look too hard to find failures. At the same time, as a historian, I don't go looking for failures or successes. I'm just trying to figure out what happened and why. Maybe the most important failure, at least during the first encounters between colonists and Indians, was the failure of both sides to understand each other. Columbus called the native inhabitants of the Americas Indians because he thought he was in the Indies. Spanish conquistadors in Mexico referred to the temples in Tenochtitlan as mosques because they reminded them of the mosques the Moors had worshipped in Spain before they had driven them out. The English settlers in Massachusetts at first didn't believe that the Indians' agricultural plots were real farms because the Indians didn't plant in neat rows but rather put the corn, beans, and squash together in one field so that the bean plants could climb up the corn stalks while the squash spread out on the ground. The English thought these plants were just growing wildly. More failures to understand, John. When European colonists showed up in the Americas, they accidentally brought with them the microbes that caused smallpox and measles. These diseases were previously unknown in the Americas, so no Indians had acquired immunities. When the diseases first struck Indian communities, many of them did precisely the wrong thing. Rather than quarantine those who were suffering, everyone would gather around them to help them, which only allowed the microbe to spread more easily. It's not that colonists understood what was happening much better. Most adult colonists had been exposed to these diseases as children in Europe and survived, and thus had acquired lifelong immunities. But both Catholic and Protestant religious leaders attributed the deaths of the Indians and the health of the colonists to divine providence. John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts, wrote in 1634 that "the natives, they are all near dead of the smallpox, so as the Lord had cleared our title to what we possess." Indians and colonists at first failed to understand each other when they signed agreements over land. It is not true that Indians had no conception of land ownership. They had a clear sense of usufruct rights, that being the rights to use property without owning it. Usufruct rights could be exclusive. In other words, we can hunt here, but you can't. When some of the first treaties were signed between Indians and Europeans, the Indians thought they were granting the colonists the shared use of the land. They thought they were granting usufruct rights to the colonists. They were rather surprised to find out that the colonists thought they were acquiring the land outright. Also, the Indians assumed that the colonists were going to live under their jurisdiction. For instance, when Chinese investors buy a condo in one of Jared Kushner's buildings, the condo does not become part of China. But when the colonists purchased land from the Indians, they assumed that they had removed that land from the legal jurisdiction of the Indians who had sold it. The Indians did not necessarily assume the same thing. They were permitting the English to live in their territory under their jurisdiction. But the Europeans' belief that they were sovereign is what made them colonists rather than immigrants. Drew. May 19th. Professor Eisenberg. Jesus, that is really good and interesting. Wow, the other guy didn't do half as much and wouldn't when asked. He actually just gave me a list of resource materials and told me to do it. It seems like you could write a whole book. May 20th. John, actually, I have written a few books, most of which have traveled under the radar, except in some small academic circles. May 20th. Professor, what are the books? May 21st. John, one was called The Destruction of the Bison, another called Mine in California, and a third called Wyatt Earp, A Vigilante Life. Some people didn't like that one because they thought I was saying that Wyatt Earp was gay. May 21st. Wait, Wyatt Earp was gay? May 23rd. John, he did share a bed with another guy for a year, but the book was mainly about his life and the politics of the time in that region of the country. May 23rd. Andrew, that certainly sounds gay, but it is hard to tell. There were fewer beds back then? I have a quick idea. Would you like to republish your book as my book? It would take a lot of pressure off me to continue my writing, and, at minimum, I would know an interesting, well-researched book was out there under my name. It would also get your work out there to a bigger audience, as I mentioned previously. I know it's a lot to ask, but just think about it. I think I could at least reuse a portion of your material to cover the remainder of my required word count. I'm sure you know how hard it is to write a whole book since you've done three. Anyway, think about it. Maybe we could eventually make a movie about a gay Wyatt Earp. That would be huge, like Brokeback Mountain meets Wyatt Earp. May 24th. John, I don't think that would work legally with my publisher. Plus, wouldn't it be odd to just switch the topic of your book midway through? I think it might confuse your readers. I do appreciate your interest in history, but I don't think this will work logistically. Good luck with your project. Andrew. Okay, I get it. But what if we publish a bunch of copies of your book with my cover on it, seeing my book is called Failure is an Option, and the stories are predominantly about my failures, but in the case of those copies that have your book in place of mine, the failure is on the buyer to get my actual book. Pretty clever, right? John. John, I'm not clear on why you would do anything like this. Andrew. Chapter 17. How I Failed at the Celebrity Favor. I know many people who are known for their work as actors, musicians, and comedians. For instance, I know Aziz Ansari. I also know Josh Groban. Actually, I don't, but I'm sure if I did, he would be pleasant enough. I once was photographed by paparazzi standing next to Sarah Jessica Parker at a street corner, and it was published in Us Weekly, and I lied to everybody that I was friends with her. One of the perks of being a celebrity or a public figure is that you occasionally receive preferential treatment and stuff that someone without this status would have to work a lot harder to obtain. It's common practice, but for example, certain people are given things complimentary just because they are notable. And that's not totally unfair. I offered to buy a drink for James McNew of the band Yola Tango once, simply because I loved Yola Tango. It's a gesture of appreciation. But sometimes it is a quid pro quo, as in commerce plays a role. When a company sends a free pair of shoes to, let's say, Ryan Philippe, that company hopes he will wear those shoes while being photographed having an affair on his wife, and the shoe company will benefit from the ensuing scandal. Or maybe they just hope he'll be photographed wearing them at the gym he is probably having an affair at. Ryan Philippe has a lot of affairs, I think. Celebrity affairs sell so many shoes. I have sometimes benefited from being a small-time celebrity. I have been bought many drinks. I received a free bicycle seat from a bike shop in New York City. Also, once the attendant at the IKEA ferry in Manhattan let me cut the line. And most notably, a hotel employee in Boston arranged, without my prompting, free porn from my hotel room. Hey, John, I got you free porn. Yeah, It's just a switcher. All the porn movies on the hotel channel will play now. For free, dude. Oh, no, man, that's not necessary. Already done, man. Enjoy. That's when you know you've made it. Free porn. Porn just given to you because someone likes your work. What a gesture of solidarity for someone in the arts community. So, I watched. I mean, it would have been rude not to. Just as a side note, the movie I watched that night starred a male actor with a particularly memorable penis in that it bent upward. Later, I learned this may be a medical condition called Peyronie's disease. That's what free porn can teach you, or any porn for that matter. Anyway, he did have one, a bent penis, and no more than a week later, a happy coincidence occurred when I was at the baggage claim area of the LA airport. Just a short distance away stood the porn actor with the bent penis. As our eyes met, he knew I recognized him and looked away dismissively. As I was staring, I quickly realized that male porn actors must hate their fans because such a large percentage of their fans are sad, middle-aged men who watch porn all the time. It's not the best feeling to get a thumbs up from perverts all day. Hey, love your bent penis! I wanted to tell him I was different and about the free porn and the unusual circumstance of my getting it, how I wasn't just another sad, lonely porn fanatic, but it was too late to try and explain. He and his bent penis got into a taxi and rode away into the hot L.A. night. Maybe I was reading it all wrong, and he recognized me and hated my work. It will forever be a mystery. One of my good friends, David Cross, is a comedian who over the years has taken me to many baseball games. He is a big baseball fan and would often get complimentary tickets when the Red Sox, our favorite team, played the Yankees. So when the opportunity came for me to receive free tickets to Yankee Stadium, I was eager to return the favor. Now, I had not ever received free tickets to a game before, so it was a momentous occasion. And here's how it went down. At the time, I was in a cartoon called Home Movies, where I voiced a belligerent elementary school soccer coach named John McGurk. Scott Van Pelt, an ESPN sports announcer, was a fan of the character, so he contacted me to do some comedy spots as Coach McGurk to be played as interstitial segments on his new radio show for ESPN, which had just been acquired by ABC. I recorded a rant about Tiger Woods seeming too clean and virtuous to be believed, and that it was clear he was hiding some sort of dark, sex-fueled secret life. This was around 2006. Scott Van Pelt wrote me after hearing it, saying ABC was uncomfortable with the content because I mentioned Tiger Woods and sex too much. It was perfectly reasonable for ESPN to protect themselves from libel, but my fake coach character did technically break the Tiger Woods scandal story 3 years before it was revealed in the media. That's pretty good sports reporting from a cartoon character. Anyway, my payment for the gig was tickets to a Red Sox game at Yankee Stadium, which Van Pelt said he could obtain with no problem, even though they couldn't use the material I gave them. He sent me the tickets, and I called David and boasted that I had gotten free Red Sox-Yankees tickets from ESPN. I added, they must be some really good seats, because on the tickets, it read something along the lines of special seating. We took the subway up to Yankee Stadium, and when we got in, I handed the tickets to the usher, who looked at them curiously. He stood there for a moment and then radioed someone. I was pretty confident at this point that my tickets were very impressive. I mean, the guy had to radio his boss. These were likely some VIP press credential seats. We would probably be hobnobbing with Giuliani and Bernie Kerik, eating free Plateau de Fruits de Mer. I winked at David, believing I had set him up better than he had ever done for me. Another usher came over and looked at the tickets, and the two, seemingly stumped, looked at each other. He radioed for a third usher to come over. Now, three people were looking at the tickets. Maybe we had field passes, or we were going to be brought to the locker room. Something big was brewing. Finally, the third usher said, "Oh, yeah, I know where these are. Follow me." This was the old Yankee Stadium, so we were standing in the section behind home plate under the overhang. The original Yankee Stadium had a huge overhang which draped over the seating running from the second tier over about half the seating area directly behind home plate. And he walked us back up the stairs into the corridor where the food vendors were. We walked for a minute or two, until we reached an area in the hallway to the side, like an inset space set back from the main interior corridor in between two of the food vendors that had faded paint lines and about 10 folding chairs in front of a cut-out opening in the concrete wall. Through the cutout, the view was mainly the underside of the overhang, home plate, and the pitcher's mound. I would classify it as an aggressively obstructed view of the playing field. I would also classify it as sitting in a hallway. I would definitely classify it as special seating. The usher said, "Here you are." David looked at me sideways. The folding chairs were in painted boxes reading 1 to 10, and in front of us, within the walls of the actual stadium, through our cutout rectangular opening, was the handicapped seating area. The seats were conveniently located for concessions, but it was almost impossible to see the field. It was like sitting in seats assigned for registered sex offenders. It felt as if we were on a practical joke show. At least, that's what David assumed. A few feet behind us, people gathered in lines for food. So, now you understand the level of free gifts someone in my position receives. Free tickets to a hallway very near a baseball game. I sat in ignominy for the first few innings. I will say it was humbling, and a lesson learned that if you ever enter into a quid pro quo arrangement with Scott Van Pelt, don't settle on tickets. After about 3 innings, 2 couples came in, dressed from head to toe in Yankees apparel, Yankees hats, Yankees shirts, even Yankees sweatpants. One of the women was even holding a Yankees flag. As Red Sox fans, this was adding insult to injury. Not only were we sitting behind a concrete wall, but now we'd been joined by really obnoxious Yankee fans. They were very loud and excited to be there. We struck up a conversation, and they kept reiterating what really big Yankees fans they were. After a few minutes, we told them we were actually Red Sox fans. Then one of the guys leaned over and said, "Wow, that's really good to hear. So are we. We drove from Vermont just to see the game, and we've never been to Yankee Stadium before." We were very confused. "Did you get these tickets from Scott Van Pelt?" I joked. David asked them, "Why are you all dressed like that then?" The guy leaned in, very conspiratorial. "We figured that as Red Sox fans, we would have to somehow find a way to blend in. So we went to the Yankee store and bought all this stuff to camouflage us." "Wait, so you spent hundreds of dollars on Yankees gear because you thought you were going to get savaged by Yankees fans?"
"Yeah, like we said, we'd never been to Yankee Stadium before. We heard it can get really bad for us. That's why we got the special seats, so we could be doubly protected."
This was some high level of conspiracy these Vermonters were pushing, a perfect companion piece to our seating woes. Of course, the only other people in this area would be a group of people convinced they would be killed if they sat amongst regular folks in the stadium because they were rooting for the opposing team. Are baseball fans from Vermont really so cloistered from society that they believe Yankee Stadium was some sort of Thunderdome? Oh, Vermont. After a few more innings, the Red Sox were way up, and David suggested we move into the stadium and sit in some open seats left by fans who left early. We said our goodbyes to the delusional folks from Vermont and watched the last 2 innings in pretty decent seats and left the stadium with the shared feeling that he, and not I, should provide any future tickets received for free. Failed presidential pets. Thomas Jefferson's dog, Buzzy. This Briard, brought back from France, was, according to Jefferson, one of the finest breeds of farm dogs and was put to use as a sheep herder on Jefferson's farm. As a herder, Buzzy was responsible for wrangling the sheep, preventing them from straying outside the grazing area. Yet, rumors of Buzzy having long-term sexual liaisons with one of the sheep were brought forward by some of the other sheepdogs. One dog claimed, Buzzy would have relations with the sheep behind a tree while the other sheepdogs worked. Buzzy's litter did expose several puppies with extraordinarily fluffy fur, not like a dog, but more like a sheep. Of course, there was a great deal of hemmings and hawings over Buzzy's indiscretion. James Madison's macaw. Madison, America's fourth president, was one of the founding fathers and architects of the Bill of Rights. But, at the same time, Madison was a dedicated slave owner who kept hundreds of slaves at his Virginia plantation and proposed the Three-Fifths Compromise, which counted slaves as three-fifths of a person for the purposes of apportioning representatives based on population. One anecdote from the Madison White House was that the parrot would be brought out to events on the shoulder of Madison's wife, Dolly, to proudly display the bird's ability to repeat phrases. But every time when asked, "Does Polly want a cracker?" the parrot would only reply with, "Yes, Polly wants a," unable to say cracker. This would cause much consternation for Madison and the guests, who all wanted the phrase to be repeated in full. After much debate, and in some cases heated arguments, a compromise was finally reached where they would stop asking Polly for the whole phrase and accepted her response as is. It became known as the Three-Fifths Macompromise. Andrew Jackson's parrot, Paul. This parrot, an African gray, was brought to the White House as a gift for Jackson's wife, and unlike Madison's bird, had a real gift for mimicry. After Paul's introduction to the White House, many staff noticed that several of the indigenous birds on the grounds were being systematically exterminated. Bird after bird found dead, the bird bodies piling up, until there were no birds on White House grounds except for Paul. It was a mystery that confounded the president and the staff until, one day, one of the White House groundskeepers claimed to have seen Paul fly out of the executive residence window and brutally drive a family of finches off the property with a stick, then fly over and viciously beat a wren, then fly back through the window, maniacally laughing. Amos Kendall, the postmaster, overheard Jackson and Paul talking one day, as Paul ruthlessly made her infamous statement when describing her slaughter of a bevy of doves. "This is what it sounds like when doves die." James Buchanan's dog, Lara. This Newfoundland was a constant companion to President Buchanan, and he was, and remains to this day, the only bachelor president in the White House. But President Buchanan could be suffocating, and this had detrimental effects on Lara's mood. On a 2-week trip up north, Buchanan was readying for the trip back to Washington, and Lara apparently refused to board the train. Buchanan ordered her to heel, but she just sat on the tracks. Many of the people gathered around found it curious, as did the president. It was inferred that this was a sign that Lara wanted to stay in Illinois without her owner, but Buchanan stated that dogs have no rights which man was bound to respect. Lara looked at him like, "I'm not moving, asshole." Buchanan kneeled down and looked Lara straight in the eyes and said, "In my opinion, Lara, the legislation and histories of the times, and the language used in the Declaration of Independence, show that neither the class of species who had been imported, nor their descendants, were then acknowledged as part of the people, nor intended to be included in the general words used in that memorable instrument. They had been regarded, Lara, as being of an inferior order, and altogether unfit to associate with people, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights, which man was bound to respect, and that might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit." Lara stood her ground. "Do you want a civil war?" Buchanan barked. Lara, shaken by his tone, resigned and boarded the train. From that point forward, though, Lara knew a change needed to come. Rutherford B. Hayes's Mastiff Duke and his cat Siam. In the beginnings of American industrialization, Hayes oversaw a great deal of infrastructure expansion during his tenure as president. His dog, Duke, was no stranger to that. Being a British Mastiff, Duke was accustomed to a high standard. As Duke aged, he became larger and more phlegmatic, and was increasingly frustrated by the length of the walk from the solarium, where he used to lounge in the day, to the kitchen, where he was fed his ground lamb giblets. He loved his ground lamb giblets. In fact, he loved them so much, Duke added a meal between breakfast and lunch so as to eat more, but the added walk was affecting his mood. Along with John Jack Casement, chief engineer of the Union Pacific Railroad, he designed tracks that would run from the solarium through the center hall, down the stairs, next to the music room, through the basement hall, to the kitchen. Once the plan was completed, Duke approached Siam, who had just arrived at the White House via Hong Kong.
"Despite your slight and slender constitution, you are to build me this railway track, so I am less taxed to receive my feedings," Duke told Siam.
Siam asked, "What's in it for me?"
Duke replied, "Nothing."
Siam reluctantly built the tracks, and the first trans-White House railway was completed. Warren Harding's dog, Laddie Boy. The Gilded Age is remembered by many as a time of extravagant wealth and a willful disregard of the underclass. Laddie Boy knew this dynamic all too well, but was loyal to his master. He came from modest means, but turned his back on this upon getting a taste of the sweet life, and that went for his sexual appetites as well. As he used to say when asked about the poor of his country, "Mine is not to reason why, mine is just to eat that pie." Yes, Laddie Boy was quite the Lothario, and his exploits were known throughout Washington. He took many lovers, as did Harding, and together they were a rakish duo. President Harding referred to Laddie Boy as his wing dog, and together they were known to hold infamous sex orgies in what was called the Doghouse, which also happened to be the actual White House doghouse. Much effort was given to maintain the secrecy of these illicit affairs, which was why Harding and Laddie Boy insisted on all participants, dogs and women, to wear masks and enter with the password, Fidolio. It has been estimated that Laddie Boy slept with more than 20,000 dogs and some 10 women in his lifetime. Herbert Hoover's dog, King Tut. Hoover was known as a fair-minded bureaucrat, but his administration was quickly saddled with the crippling economic devastation that was the Great Depression. Families were devastated, unemployment was at an all-time high, and people all over were desperate. Also, Prohibition ruled the land. Hoover called Prohibition a noble experiment, but it caused a huge surge in organized crime, and not everyone believed in the experiment. King Tut was squarely in that camp. Much of the illegal activity during Prohibition involved bootlegging or rum-running, but King Tut got involved early in pant-legging or leg-humping, which many dogs were recruited into at the time. Pant-legging was a diversionary tactic used by the bootleggers. Dogs would be dispatched to hump the legs of the Bureau of Prohibition agents while the liquor deliveries were made. King Tut was the head of a particularly effective group of dogs known as the Touchables, who were aggressive in their tactics and made it possible for smuggling of millions of gallons of illegal liquor to speakeasies up and down the East Coast. Harry Truman's dog, Feller. Truman is attributed as saying, "If you want a friend in Washington, buy a dog." Well, he didn't, but one was sent to him as a gift. A cocker spaniel named Feller. But Truman was not a dog lover and never really wanted Feller around. There was much discussion of whether to get rid of Feller or keep him.
Truman believed that getting rid of him would send a message that the acquisition of future dogs would be strongly discouraged. But some felt that it would be more humane to just keep him and deal with the repercussions. Truman felt getting rid of him, even though many would suffer, was a demonstrable show of force, the likes of which no one had ever seen before. Instead of hearing from more dog lovers, Truman put Feller in a box labeled Little Dog in the dead of the night, flew him 6 hours away, and airdropped him so that it would be too far for Feller to find his way back. Many felt that what Truman did was wrong, but no dogs ever returned to the Truman White House.
Chapter 18. Buying a Motorcycle and How I Failed to Ride It. I've had a long failed history with transportation. My mother brags that I learned to walk very early, but on the whole, most of my other forays into different modes of transportation have been problematic. When I turned 16, my father bought me my first car. It was nice of him. It was a bumblebee yellow MG Midget. I don't remember asking him for it. Maybe it was one of those gifts that was really more for him than for me. Not that I didn't like it, but it was a bit much in that cars are sometimes outward expressions of the personalities of the people who drive them. For example, if you drive a huge pickup truck with big-ass exhaust pipes jutting from the cab and bumper stickers that read "White Lives Matter" and "Jesus Hates Obama," you might just be a redneck. Or a really lazy liberal who bought a used pickup. You don't want to stand in opposition to the aura of your vehicle or contraindicate. It's too confusing. Most people respect these norms and have a car that suits their personality, but many people overcompensate and overreach. Some people who lack self-confidence will, for instance, buy big fancy vehicles as a proxy for their lack of inner self-worth, or big motorcycles, or big dogs, or big coats. I've always wanted to make enough money just to buy the world's biggest boat so I could name it Overboard. But most overcompensations are small-scale efforts, like that time I wore a puka shell necklace when I was 14 for about a year and pretended that I was into surfing. But in the case of the MG, despite the fact that it was a tiny car, I could barely see over the wheel, and it attracted a ton of attention, which was anathema to my personality. My inner car was more of a Plymouth Horizon, or at best, a Honda Accord, one that doesn't attract gawkers. Driving an MG compels the driver to conform to the notion that he or she is the kind of person who drives an MG. That kind of person is probably a college history professor or an ex-British MP, not a Jewish kid in high school. But like I said, sometimes you overreach or you're forced to. About 10 years ago, I bought an old dirt bike on eBay. It was one of those impulse buys. I thought a dirt bike would be a useful thing to have in New York City because I often have to travel from the West Village to the East Village to go to bars, and this would make the trip far more convenient and exponentially less safe. I don't want to pass the buck, but Amy, my girlfriend, also had something to do with it. She obsessively bids on stuff on eBay, vintage clothing, area rugs, and once, a pencil drawing by an 11-year-old girl of Lance Bass lying in a field with a pony. She won it for $12, and it is disturbing and beautiful. So, in a way, she was my conduit to eBay. I found an old Kawasaki that looked nice and won a bidding war that escalated the price to something like $900. When it comes to financial transactions, I have a hard time with confrontation, so if I walk into a store, let's say a furniture store, and I'm looking at a chair, and a salesperson casually approaches, I immediately buy the chair, almost before they even speak. It's like the I'll take it theory of economics, or laissez-faire carelessness. It's why I have close to 5,000 chairs. This also goes for eBay, a terrible milieu for my condition, which involves almost unconscious clicking to bid more. This problem with having no sense of financial limits has bled into my comedy life. Early in my career, I performed at this small venue on the Lower East Side in a show called Eating It. It was a showcase show with a bunch of stand-ups performing short sets for $20. I was not exactly rich at the time. I mean, I could pay my rent, but $20 wasn't meaningless. I used to perform in a duo with a comedian named Mike Lee, and our performing moniker was cleverly Mike and John. But this partnership, right away, cut my $20 take by half. For one particular show, we decided that we would hire male escorts to perform live sex acts in our place. It was one of those ideas that I knew would make 4 to 6 people in the audience very happy, and the rest very uncomfortable. So the host would introduce Mike and John, and then in lieu of us, 2 male erotic dancers in t-shirts, one reading Mike and the other reading John, would go on stage and perform sex acts to music. Surprise! Sure, arguably not comedy, but certainly not devoid of value, until you enter into, as it turns out, the very complicated world of gay escorts. I started with a gay escort agency pulled off the back of the Village Voice. From there, I secured 2 men who were interested in the gig for the fee of $300, plus an additional manager fee. So far, so good. I believe it was worth it, even for a show in the back room of a bar for, at most, 50 unsuspecting people. I gave out the information, and Tony, the manager at the agency, told me they would contact me with the details once they secured the dancers. After a few hours, I received a call from a guy named Frank. He said he was one of the dancers Tony called about the comedy show gig. Frank asked me if I was interested in working independent of the agency because Tony takes a huge cut of the gig money. If agreed, he told me to call the agency and cancel the gig. I'm a democratic socialist, so I am always in favor of labor over usurious management practices. I told Frank that I was good with his plan. A few hours passed, and then I got a call from a guy named Luan, who sounded Brazilian. He asked if I was the one who spoke to Frank after talking to Tony about booking the 2 dancers. I was definitely getting the sense that I was about to be enmeshed in a very complicated arrangement, admittedly one that I should have known might have happened when dealing with the world of low-end adult entertainment. Luan told me that he spoke to Tony about the gig, but he was curious why Frank called directly. He figured he should call Tony at the agency because he was suspicious that Frank, who, according to Luan, was prone to erratic behavior, was trying to scam the agency. Classic good gay escort, bad gay escort. I told him I didn't want to get between them and maybe would just try another agency. Then, Tony called. He had talked to Luan, and Luan tipped him off to Frank's chicanery. My main interest was not to talk to any more gay escorts or gay escort agents, and Tony was very mad at me. He told me that Frank couldn't work outside the agency, making it clear to me that Luan had flipped on Frank. Tony said he was just trying to run a good, clean operation and that Frank was compromising that by getting client info from the agency, then contacting the client directly and telling them to cancel with the agency. I explained that all I wanted was a couple of guys to perform gay sex acts on stage for 5 minutes, and any way that could come to fruition, I was on board. Lots of serious shit going down at Gay Apple Escorts. The night of the show, we were to meet Frank and Luan at a bar across from the venue to go over the plan for the show. Luan showed up, but Frank was late. Luan was tall, lean, and buttery brown-complexioned with straightened black hair like second album Prince. Frank was a wild card based on the phone calls, as you know, so we were worried that he wouldn't show up, but he did. He was not what I expected, very plain-looking, almost suburban, like Joe Piscopo. As I started describing the bit, telling them that they would both enter the stage after we were introduced and then they could just start playing out their gay sex act, Frank quickly spoke up. I'm all gay. Silence. Okay. Yeah, I'm not gay, so this is a problem. Right, but I got you from a gay escort service. Yeah. And I told you about the bit, so I assumed... Well, yeah, but, you know, now I'm here. He pointed at Luan. I'm not comfortable with this. I'll dance with him, but I'm not doing that other stuff. I was a little stumped, and the show was in like 10 minutes, and slightly panicked, because without the live gay sex part, it wasn't much of a bit. And it didn't seem like a sustainable plan to completely refuse the job you're hired to do, but how do I negotiate with him considering the nature of it? It was a real crocodile's dilemma, or in this case, what is now referred to as the gay escort paradox. How is a gay escort not gay if he is a gay escort? I asked Luan if he could call anybody he knew, and he scolded me.
I told you, you should have gone through the agency. Maybe for 200 extra I would do it,
Frank chimed in. So Frank, who I had grown to trust over the course of these few days, finally showed his true colors. I knew, though, it was too late to stop now. $100, I countered.
Deal.
The bit went off, and it was a real litmus test at the idea that people do not like to be surprised with live sex acts. Many people walked out, and as for Frank not being gay, it was really never established, although him performing oral sex in front of 50 people certainly looked gay. Maybe I was being scammed all along. I did notice that they glanced at each other during our pre-meeting in a way that made me think they knew each other before and had schemed the classic I'm not gay, gay escort con. On the financial side, however, the bit ended up costing $500, and I made $10 back, so this speaks directly to my financial prowess. Always in the red. So, you can imagine, the motorcycle purchase on eBay didn't go smoothly either. After I won the bid, I read down the page for the details others might have noticed first, that the bike would have to be shipped to me, and that this would cost $400, because it was coming from Iowa. Iowa is in the Midwest, by the way, and a great distance from New York. I like to involve my sister Jody in most of my deals, so I decided to have it shipped to her house outside of New Haven. A few weeks passed, and I arrived in Connecticut to welcome my dirt bike from Iowa. An 18-wheeler pulled into my sister's driveway. This was semi-exciting, pun. Then, the driver got out and unloaded a pallet with not one, but two dirt bikes. I tried to figure out how someone could accidentally send someone an extra motorcycle, but the driver of the truck didn't want to discuss it. Later, the owner would email me to explain that he decided to throw in an extra, non-working bike for parts to fix the working one. It was a fixer-upper's dream. Unfortunately, I can't fix anything. Also, I know nothing about motorcycles. Also, neither bike worked. With the reluctant help of my sister, I found a local handyman to see if he could get either of them running. He couldn't, but he said that for a small sum, he could truck one of the bikes to a New Haven dealership for repair. So, 2 months after my eBay victory, I was in for an additional $400. Then, the dealership called. They had it working. Another $150. I went back to Connecticut to pick it up. I was excited. Soon, I would be on my iron stallion. As I paid, the repair guy informed me that I couldn't ride the bike because it was not street ready. It needed signal lights, headlights, etc., which would have cost in the range of $300 more to install. I didn't want to spend any more money on it, so I called the handyman, and for some more money, he trucked the bike back to my sister's. I was now hovering around the $1,800 mark, and I had yet to ride my vintage eBay dirt bike. Not long after, I went to my sister's for Passover. I decided I didn't care if the bike was street ready. It was a motorcycle. It was Passover. It was time to put the rubber to the road. I started it up and put it in gear and rode to the gas station to fill the tank. For all my money spent, here was the reward. That unparalleled feeling of man and machine entwined in singular purpose. I gassed it up, got back in the saddle, and pulled out of the station directly in front of a police car. I pretended not to see it, feigning confidence, but the cruiser abruptly made a U-turn and hit his lights. I rode, dejected, the 100 yards or so to my sister's driveway. The cop wrote up a $200 ticket, as my family and girlfriend all glared at me from the window. That was the last time I rode my vintage dirt bike that I won on eBay and waited 3 months for. Total rubber to the road time, 45 seconds. The only positive thing to come of it was that I made the crime blotter in my sister's small-town paper for driving an unregistered motorcycle without a license, with an additional charge of riding without the proper signals. In a town like my sister's, that makes me infamous. I'm sure families are still gathered around their tables, retelling the story about the mysterious stranger on the dirt bike. In the end, I guess I will think twice before bidding on eBay again. Although, I am interested in buying a submarine. Chapter 19. Midnight Pajama Jam. or how I failed at launching a kid's show. Not everything in my career has been successful, but sometimes failed endeavors hold the best memories. In comedy, as with everything, there's so much out there, unheeded, left aside, millions of moments just